This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Secret Wife by Jill Poole, read by Laura Kerman and Thomas Judd.
Prologue. Lake Akanabi, New York State, the 19th of July, 2016. It was 29 hours since Kitty Fisher had left her husband, and in that time she had travelled 3,713 miles. The in-flight magazine had said there were 3,461 miles between London and New York, and the hire car's sat-nav told her she had driven 252 miles since leaving the airport. A whole ocean and half a state lay between her and Tom. She should have been upset, but instead she felt numb. Back in the UK, it was 4:30 on a Sunday afternoon, and she wondered what Tom was doing, then grimaced as she pictured him pottering around the house in his jogging bottoms and T-shirt. He would no doubt have called her closest friends, all innocents, asking if they knew where she was. How long would it take him to work out she had flown to America to look for the lakeside cabin she'd inherited from her great-grandfather? She had been careful not to leave any paperwork behind, so he didn't have the address. Let him stew for a while. It served him right for his infidelity. She shuddered at the word, an involuntary image of the messages on his phone flashing into her brain. She was still in shock. Nothing felt real. Don't think about it. Stop thinking. The woman on the sat-nav was comfortingly sure of herself. In 200 yards, take a left onto Big Brook Road. It felt nice to be told what to do. That's what she needed when the rest of her life was falling apart. But a few minutes later, the voice lady seemed to get it wrong. You have reached your destination, she said, but all Kitty could see was dense forest lining the road on either side. She drove further, but the voice urged her to turn around. Kitty got out of the car to explore on foot and, peering through the trees, discovered a track overgrown with waist-high grass and hanging branches. She consulted the map that had been sent with the cabin's ownership documents and decided this must be it. The car's paintwork would get scratched if she tried to drive down, so she set off on foot, pushing her way through the thicket. There was a droning of insects and a strong smell of greenness, like lawn cuttings after rain. Before long, she could see the steely glint of Lake Akanabi, with pinpricks of light dancing on the surface. When she reached the shore, she looked around, squinting at her map. The cabin should have been right there. And then she noticed a mound about 12 feet tall, camouflaged by creeping plants. It was 30 years since anyone had lived there, and Kitty was prepared for the cabin to be reduced to a pile of rubble. Instead, it was as if the forest had created a cocoon to protect it from the elements. Weeds wrapped themselves around the foundations, pushed in through broken windows, and formed a carpet over the roof. The entrance was barely visible through a mass of twisted greenery, but the cabin's location, nestled on a gentle slope just yards from the pebbly shore, was stunning. She walked over to look more closely. A jetty sticking out into the lake had long since collapsed, leaving a few forlorn struts. A sapling had grown up through the 4 or 5 steps to the cabin's porch, causing them to buckle and snap, and its roots tangled through the fractured wood like a nest of snakes. But the corrugated steel roof appeared to have stayed watertight, protecting the walls beneath. Concrete foundations, she noted. Treading with care, Kitty climbed onto the porch, where rusty chains hanging from the ceiling and some fractured planks on the floor indicated there had once been a swing seat. She imagined her great-grandfather sitting there, looking out at the view, perhaps with a beer in his hand. Pushing aside the foliage, she reached the cabin door and found it wasn't locked. Inside it was dim and musty, with a smell of damp mushrooms and old wood. Dust motes danced in shafts of light pouring through gaps in the creepers. When her eyes adjusted, Kitty saw there was one large room with a rusty stove, an old iron bed topped by a mouldy mattress, a wooden desk, and heaps of rubbish everywhere, yellowed newspapers, ancient cans of food, and a pair of perished rubber galoshes. She stepped carefully across the room. Through a doorway, there was a bathroom with a stained tub, basin, and toilet. A cobweb-covered shaving brush nestled on a shelf. To her astonishment, the toilet flushed when she pulled the handle, and after a low creaking sound, dark water came out of the tap. She guessed they must be hooked up to a water source on the hill behind, and that there was a below-ground septic tank, but it must be at least 30 years since that tank was last emptied. She turned back into the bed-cum-sitting room and walked around, checking the condition of the walls and ceiling. Thankfully, the floor held firm underfoot. She reckoned she could even stay the night once she'd cleared the rubble and torn back the jungle to let in some air. Out on the porch, she took in the view. A couple of silver birch trees stood between her and the beach, which was lapped by tiny waves. No signs of human habitation were visible, and no traffic sound intruded. The opposite shore about a mile away was thick with forest. It was just her and the trees and the lake, and it was glorious. Kitty walked back to the car to retrieve her bags and drag them down the track, flattening the grass in her wake. She ate a salt beef and gherkin sandwich from the selection she had bought at the airport, drank a can of 7-Up, then donned some sturdy gloves to start tearing at the creepers that smothered her cabin. Already it felt like hers, she noted. Already she was falling in love with it. One of the plants was what she and her school friends called Sticky Willy. They used to try and stick it on each other's backs without being noticed. Another type of creeper filled the air with spores that tickled the back of her throat. She was careful not to let any leaves touch her skin, because she knew they had poison ivy in America, but she wasn't sure what it looked like. A swarm of tiny black flies rose into the air and floated away in the breeze. She worked with grim determination, hoping that by totally exhausting her muscles, she could quell the panicky thoughts that clamoured in her brain. Don't think about Tom. Stop thinking. She had brought her mobile phone and laptop through force of 21st century habit, but both were switched off. She couldn't bear to listen to his excuses and self-justifications, simply didn't want to deal with any of it. When she'd yanked back most of the overgrowth, she saw that the weathered wooden slats made the cabin look like an organic part of the wooded landscape. Despite having just one room, it was big, perhaps 20 feet long, with windows all around, and the sloping roof had a little chimney sticking out. She went inside again and loaded debris into some heavy-duty bin bags she'd brought along, stopping to read a few yellowed news headlines. The accident at the Chernobyl power plant in Russia. The explosion of the Challenger space shuttle. The springs on the bed had long gone, so she hauled it outside to dispose of later, then unrolled the sleeping bag she had brought and spread it in one corner. By the time she finished, the sun was lowering over the lake, and birds were squawking loudly, expending their final burst of energy for the day. She went to sit on the porch to listen. A whip-poor will called, and it sounded for all the world like a wolf whistle. Shadowy bats zipped by, and frogs croaked in the distance. Suddenly, she saw something glint under the fractured wood of the steps, nestled amongst the tree roots. She lay down full length, stretching her arm to grasp it, and was immediately surprised by the weight of the object. She pulled it out and saw it was a golden oval, less than an inch long, studded with tiny coloured jewels, blue, pink, and amber, set within swirls of gold tendrils, like flowers on a vine. It looked expensive. On the back, she could make out some scratched engraving, but it had been rubbed away over the years. There was a hole in the top, and she assumed it had been threaded on a chain. Someone must have been upset to lose such a stunning pendant. She'd never seen anything quite like it. Kitty slipped it deep into the pocket of her jeans and opened another airport sandwich, turkey and salad this time. She ate it for supper, washed down with a miniature bottle of Chenin Blanc she'd brought from the plane as she sat with her legs dangling off the edge of the porch. In front of her, the trees swayed in a slight breeze, and the smooth surface of the lake reflected the dramatic colours of the sky, changing from pale pink to mauve to gold and then bronze, as vivid and surreal as the painted opening title shots of a Hollywood movie.
Chapter 1. Sarsko Selo, Russia, September 1914. Dmitry Malama drifted to consciousness from a deep slumber, vaguely aware of murmuring voices and the whisper of a cool breeze on his face. He had a filthy headache, a nagging, gnawing pain behind the temples, which was aggravated by the brightness of the light. Suddenly, he remembered he was in a hospital ward. He'd been brought there the previous evening, and the last thing he recalled was a nurse giving him laudanum swirled in water. And then he remembered his leg. Had they amputated it in the night? Ever since he'd been injured at the front, he'd lived in fear that infection would set in and he would lose it. He opened his eyes and raised himself onto his elbows to look. There were two shapes. He flicked back the sheet and was hugely relieved to see his left leg encased in bandages, but still very much present. He wiggled his toes to check, then sank onto the pillow again, trying to ignore the different kinds of pain from his leg, his head, and his gut. At least he had two legs. Without them, he could no longer have served his country. He'd have been sent home to live with his mother and father, fit for nothing, a pitiful creature hobbling along on a wooden stump.
"You're awake. Would you like something to eat?"
A dumpy nurse with the shadow of a moustache sat by his bed, and without waiting for an answer, offered a spoonful of gruel. His stomach heaved, and he turned his head away.
"Very well. I'll come back later,"
she said, touching his forehead briefly with cool fingers. He closed his eyes and drifted into a half-dream state. He could hear sounds in the ward around him, but his head was heavy as lead, his thoughts a jumble of images. Of the war, of his friend Malevich shot and bleeding on the grass, of his sisters, of home. In the background, he heard the tinkle of girlish laughter. It didn't sound like the plain nurse who had tended him earlier. He opened his eyes slightly and saw the tall, slender shapes of two young nurses in glowing white headdresses and long, shapeless gowns. If he'd just awoken for the first time in that place, he might have feared he had died and was seeing angels.
"I know you,"
one of the angels said, gliding over to his bedside.
"You were in the Imperial Guard at the Peterhof Palace. Weren't you the one who dived into the sea to rescue a dog?"
Her voice was low and pretty. As she came closer, he realized with a start that she was Grand Duchess Tatiana, the second daughter of Tsar Nicholas. While Olga, the eldest, looked like her father, Tatiana had her mother's faintly oriental bone structure. She was gazing at him with intense grey-violet eyes, waiting for an answer.
"Yes, I'm afraid that was me. My uniform was ruined, my captain was furious, and the dog was a stray who shook himself down and ran off without so much as a thank you."
He smiled.
"I'm surprised you heard about it, Your Imperial Highness."
She returned his smile.
"I heard some guards discussing it and asked them to point you out. You must be a dog lover."
"Very much so. I have two at home, a Borzoi and a Laika. They're scamps, but I miss them terribly."
"My father is fond of Borzois. He had one, he said, was more intelligent than most human beings, and he was grief-stricken when it died."
She wrinkled her nose prettily.
"But the ones we keep in the kennels bark constantly. I'd love to have a dog of my own in the palace, but it would have to be quieter. Perhaps you could advise."
He felt honoured that a Grand Duchess was conversing with him in this natural, everyday fashion. "Of course, Your Imperial Highness. Do you prefer small or large dogs?"
"I think small. And there's no need to call me Your Imperial Highness. I am a nurse here, not a royal. Mama, my sister Olga and I are all training as nurses to help the war effort. These days I am known as Nurse Romanova III, while they are 1 and 2.
He chuckled at the impersonal moniker.
"Do you like terriers, Nurse Romanova III? The Black Russian Terrier is a clever dog and not too boisterous. Spaniels are also popular with ladies for their silky coats. And then there are small breeds of bulldog. I rather like French bulldogs."
She clapped her hands.
"Oh, yes, I love those serious wrinkled faces, as if they have the cares of the world on their shoulders."
Her sister Olga, the other angel in white, called to say she was going through to the next ward. Dmitri expected Tatiana to follow, but instead she lingered.
"I see you have a leg wound," she said. "Is it terribly painful? Can I get you anything?"
He shook his head.
"Thank you, I'm fine.
I'm just annoyed that I was careless enough to get myself wounded in the first week of war. Is it a bullet wound?
He thought back to the moment when he ran out to collect Malevich from the field, dragging him by his collar. In retrospect, he'd felt a blow on his thigh, but thought nothing of it as he concentrated on saving his friend.
Yes, I didn't realize I'd been hit until we got back to base. It was odd because the pain and bleeding didn't start until then.
All of a sudden, the blood had begun to gush, and he'd collapsed on the grass. It was a mystery why it hadn't bled earlier, out on the field, as if one of the saints was looking after him. After his collapse, he remembered feeling very hot and starting to shiver, his teeth clenched, and they'd ripped off his trousers to see a ragged hole going all the way through his left thigh and grazing the right. Fortunately, the bullet had not lodged inside. Perhaps that's what had enabled surgeons to save the leg. Over the last weeks, he'd been transported back from the front at Gumbinnen, East Prussia, via various medical stations to the Catherine Palace in St. Petersburg, where the grand staterooms had been converted into wards. Tatiana asked his regiment, and exclaimed when she heard he was in the 8th Voznesensk Uhlans.
"You are one of my own men. I must take especially good care of you."
Both Olga and Tatiana had been given honorary command of their own regiments on their 14th birthdays.
"It's a great honor to be nursed by my colonel," he grinned. "But I suppose I will have to behave myself with you around."
They chatted for a while about the war, triggered only a few weeks earlier by the German Kaiser's rampant militarism. It was still a shock to Dmitri, and Tatiana told him it was even more shocking to them, as they had so many German relatives, their mother having been born there. She called the Kaiser a swine. Olga glanced in to look for her sister and made a brief, impatient gesture with outspread hands.
"I must get to work," Tatiana said. "I am supposed to accompany a more experienced nurse, and she will be waiting. But tell me, is there anything I can do to make your stay more comfortable?"
"I don't suppose you could lend me a book. Any book at all. I love to read." He hoped he wasn't being presumptuous.
"I would return it, of course."
She seemed delighted.
"I too love reading. Who are your favourite authors?"
He hesitated. So many good writers these days were anti-Tsarist. Alexander Kuprin, Maxim Gorky, Ivan Bunin. He must choose from an earlier era.
"Tolstoy, of course, and Chekhov." "I agree with you," she said. "I much prefer the classics to the modern writers. My absolute favourite is Turgenev. Have you read Fathers and Sons?"
Dmitri was surprised, as the novel dealt with the younger generation rejecting the values of the old aristocratic order.
"Not since I was a boy. I love the poetry of Turgenev's language. He conjures images that stir the soul."
She was amused.
"You sound like a writer yourself."
He made a face. "I used to keep a journal as a youth, but not for a long while now. It was rather whining and self-indulgent."
"Really? I keep a journal. I try to describe events of the day truthfully. I like the challenge of finding exactly the right words, and often they come to me when I'm doing something completely different. Working here in the hospital, or doing my embroidery, or..."
She stopped, colouring slightly. He liked the way she spoke, slowly, considering her words, and the intelligence he could see in her eyes.
"In that case, you have the instincts of a writer."
She laughed.
"Oh, I could hardly pretend. No one reads my journal but me."
"Without an audience, you can express your truest feelings. I used to find writing very useful for understanding myself. You know how sometimes you react instinctively in ways that puzzle you? You think, 'Why am I angry? Why does that make me sad?' It's fascinating to unravel the tiny spark that provoked the reaction. Perhaps just an unintended nuance, something that struck a chord and triggered the emotion of a much earlier experience. Human nature is the most compelling study of all." He stopped, feeling he was talking too much and perhaps boring her, but she seemed to be listening intently.
"I know exactly what you mean,"
she said, biting her lip as if some example were flitting unseen through her mind. Dmitri watched, thinking what an open, natural girl she appeared to be. He had expected the Tsar's daughters to be haughty and sophisticated, like the grandest ladies of the St. Petersburg aristocracy. But Tatiana did not seem to have any airs. She spoke to him as if to an equal.
"Nurse Romanova III,"
a woman called from the doorway.
"I'm coming, Sister Chyabotarieva."
She gave Dmitri a quick, warm smile, said,
"Till tomorrow,"
then hurried from the ward. Dmitri watched her go with a smile on his lips, having completely forgotten his pain. He wondered what age Tatiana must be, then worked out that she was 17, 6 years younger than him. In her manner she seemed younger still, and she was much more beautiful than he had ever imagined when he'd seen her from a distance. Her skin was creamy perfection, her eyes like deep pools, her lips stained as if by wild berries. If she had not been a Romanov, Dmitri would have flirted with her. Over his years in the Imperial Guard, he had made a number of conquests amongst the young titled ladies of St. Petersburg, although none had captured his interest for long. But here, he thought, here was a girl he could easily fall in love with. Chapter 2. Next morning, Dmitri opened his eyes and gazed up at the ceiling, where cupids, griffins, and other mythological creatures danced in cornflower blue semicircles. A vast chandelier of multiple tiers glinted in the sunlight. The walls were of white silk with delicately painted blue flowers. He was in the blue drawing room of the Catherine Palace, a place he had sometimes glanced into when serving in the Imperial Guard. His neighbour in the next bed, a man named Stepanov, told him that the staterooms of the Winter Palace had also been converted into makeshift wards for wounded officers. Surfaces had been cleared of ornament and the priceless furniture replaced by hospital beds, but the andirons and fireguard were gilded bronze, and the elaborate clock on the mantel showed the Greek gods Bacchus and Momus in marble and bronze. The wealth of the Romanovs was unfathomable. The royal family no longer lived in the Catherine Palace, preferring the relative intimacy of the nearby Alexander Palace in winter, the Peterhof in summer, and the extravagant luxury of the royal yacht, Standard, or their Crimean palace at Livadia for holidays. Most of the stately palaces lining the Baltic shores in St. Petersburg, where Dmitri had worked, were kept for ceremonial purposes, to entertain visiting dignitaries, and as the setting for state occasions. What must it be like to grow up with such limitless wealth, Dmitri wondered? To have an elephant house and Chinese theatre in your garden, to be driven around in shiny new automobiles by uniformed chauffeurs, to be able to buy whatever your heart desired. Tatiana seemed an unspoiled girl, but the sheer grandeur of her upbringing must set her apart. He knew her clothes were made by French couturiers, and her hats shipped from a fashionable store in London, that her perfume came from Brocard & Co., and her shoes from Henry Weiss. He had often noticed deliveries arriving by special messenger. Although he was the son of an army general, a member of a well-connected upper-class family, surely he couldn't ever hope to become close to Tatiana. It was impossible, wasn't it? He watched the clock, wondering what time she would arrive. The previous day it had been mid-morning when she stopped by his bed. He managed to eat some breakfast and had his dressing changed by the moustached nurse. She brought him a bowl of water and a razor, and he shaved, then combed his hair, keen to look presentable for Tatiana's visit. She bounced in at 10, her cheeks flushed from hurrying, 3 books tucked under her arm.
"I hope I didn't keep you waiting. I had lessons to attend. Then I had to go to the Znamenye Church to pray for our soldiers. Here, would any of these interest you?"
She placed the books on the bed cover, then pulled up a chair and sat by his bed. "How kind of you, Nurse Romanova III." Dmitri smiled. He picked up the first book, Turgenev's Fathers and Sons. "I will enjoy revisiting this to see if it lives up to memory." She watched eagerly as he examined the others. "I've never read Tolstoy's Kreutzer Sonata, so I look forward to that. And Gorky's short stories are perfect. I remember one about the cutting of a tunnel through a mountain. Have you read it?"
"Ah, that was so haunting. Do you think it can be true that mountains have a spirit that can harm those who damage them?"
Her eyes looked grey today, with flecks of violet round the edge of the irises. A tendril of auburn hair had slipped from the side of her white headdress. "I remember seeing such a tunnel being dug, and thinking that it looked like an offence against nature. Gorky has captured that sense of a wound being inflicted. Thank you for the books. I will stop being such a disruptive, demanding patient now I am so well occupied. He stroked the expensive Morocco leather binding. She glanced around, unsure whether to believe him, then realized he was pulling her leg.
Perhaps we might discuss them when you finish. I love to talk about books. I often write critiques of them in my journal.
I can't imagine when you find time to write your journal. It sounds as though your days are fully occupied. Nurse, Grand Duchess, Colonel. He was fishing, eager to know more about her life.
I write every evening before bedtime. In fact, I wrote about you last night.
She coloured.
Mama tells me you are a hero, that you rescued a wounded officer while under enemy fire. She is going to award you the Golden Arms sword.
Dmitri was surprised. It's an insurance policy all soldiers follow. If you see a chance, you slip out to bring back the wounded, hoping that one day someone will do the same for you. He didn't tell her the officer was a friend, and that he still had no word about whether Malevich had survived his wounds. He knew he would choke up if he spoke of it.
Nevertheless, I'm sure they don't give bravery awards to just anyone. I suspect you are being modest. You have a heroic air.
Her eyes were sparkling. Now he laughed. I'm not sure what a heroic air is. My father was a genuine hero. He was a cavalry general in Tsar Alexander's army, who served in many campaigns, and in 1904 became Viceroy of Georgia. He has so many decorations pinned on his jacket, it is heavy as a suit of armour. I'm just a simple cavalryman following orders.
Does your father fight in the present war?
No, he has retired to my hometown of Lozovatka in Yevkaterinskaya province.
I have never been there. Is it beautiful?
Dmitri wrinkled his nose. It's a very small town, set on a pretty river not far from the Sea of Azov. But your Imperial Highness would have no reason to go there. They have no society to speak of. In my childhood it was rural, but they have started mining for minerals, and great slashes are being torn through the landscape, just like Gorky's tunnel.
Do you come from a large family?
She was regarding him intently.
What kind of childhood did you have?
Not as large as your Imperial Highness's. I have two elder sisters, Vera and Valerina, but no brothers. The girls were always trying to rope me into their games, dressing me in costumes and making me perform in their plays. You have no idea how character-forming it is for a young boy to be forced to wear a wig and gown and have his cheeks rouged. I escaped around the age of 9 after I befriended one of the groundsmen on our family's estate. He taught me how to hunt and fish, since my father was often away from home. All in all, it was a fairly average childhood. He did not tell her about the fierce rows when his irascible father came back, and the vicious beatings he had endured, sometimes with a horsewhip.
Tell me, are your sisters married now?
Vera is married to Prince Alexander Aristovich Sani of Georgia, but Valerina still lives at home with our parents. She is 26 years old, and I hope she will yet find a husband, but she is the quieter of the two, a little shy, perhaps. I'm very close to her.
I would love to meet them, Tatiana exclaimed. I know hardly any women outside our family. Mama had just begun to allow Olga and me to attend the occasional ball or soiree when war broke out. We used to hear music floating up to the windows and see fine ladies ice skating on the Baltic, but no matter how hard we pleaded, we were scarcely ever allowed to join them. Aunt Olga, Papa's sister, would occasionally invite us. But I think the ladies felt awkward about introducing themselves to us. I should probably never have met you, Cornet Malama, had it not been for this war and your injury.
I am very glad we met, Nurse Romanova III. Our conversation is helping to relieve my frustration at being stuck in bed, my ears assailed by the grunting and snoring of my fellow officers. Her hand rested on the covers not far from his, and he longed to touch it, or even raise it to his lips. He might have done so with another woman, but dared not attempt it with the Romanov Grand Duchess. Her sister Olga came into the room and approached them. She was shorter than Tatiana, and not nearly as pretty, with coarser features and plain blue eyes.
"Who is this patient who occupies all your time?"
she asked, her eyes merry.
"Could it be Cornet Malama, the officer about whom you regaled us all last evening?"
Tatiana blushed scarlet, and Dmitri bowed his head, saying, "À votre service."
"I beg pardon for interrupting," Olga continued, "but Sister Chebotareva has asked if we will go to the annex and change dressings."
Tatiana rose.
"Thank you again for the books," Dmitri said.
"I will begin the Turgenev immediately."
"I'll stop by later to check how much you have read,"
Tatiana promised. The girl scurried out of the room, and Dmitri lay in a daze. She seemed to like him. At least she enjoyed chatting with him, and she had mentioned him to her mother and sister. Did that mean there might be a chance of a match between them? His family owned a large estate, but their wealth was nothing compared to the immense riches of the Romanovs. Would he be considered too lowly? Were they hoping to find foreign princes for all four Romanov girls, or might a Russian general's son suffice?
Stepanov called over. "Congratulations! I heard her say you were to be awarded the golden arms."
Dmitri frowned, wondering how much of the conversation Stepanov had heard. He did not feel like talking. He wanted to close his eyes and remember the sweet jasmine scent of Tatiana's skin, the directness of her gaze, the soft tone of her voice, the way her emotions flickered across her face for any who cared to read them. He opened the cover of the Turgenev novel and saw that she had written her name on the frontispiece in both Russian and English, her lettering neat and evenly spaced. He ran his finger over it lightly, then lifted the book and breathed in the smell of the pages. Should he try to stop himself falling in love with her? Already, he suspected, it might be too late.
Chapter 3
"Did you hear news of Tannenberg?"
Stepanov called, interrupting Dmitri's reverie.
"It's catastrophic. 78,000 killed or wounded, 92,000 captured, and General Samsonov dead by his own hand."
He was reading the figures from a newspaper. Dmitri already knew that the Russian Second Army had been encircled by the Germans, but hadn't heard the casualty figures till now. He felt sick to his stomach at the enormity of the slaughter.
"How could it have happened? Why is German intelligence so much better than our own? It seems they intercept all our messages, yet we are in the dark about their plans."
Stepanov grimaced.
"They are better equipped, too. Their guns have longer ranges, more explosive power. Our superior numbers count for nothing when we are sent into battle with 19th-century weapons."
Dmitri thought of the friends he had left behind at the front. Were any still alive, or had they been struck down by the indiscriminate big guns? The Russian army was the largest in the world, but the German foe was nimbler, more flexible.
"This war will be lost within months if we don't get modern equipment and become faster in the field. Our chain of command is too slow and dithery. Changes in orders take so long to be implemented, the enemy has moved on."
Stepanov was gloomy.
"According to this newspaper's editor, we can't compete with the rail network supporting the German army. We're still riding around on horseback, but the days of using cavalry in battle are numbered. A horse presents a large target, and the big guns terrify them."
Dmitri agreed, but it meant everything he had learned at the prestigious Imperial Corps de Page and then in the Uhlan Lancer Guard Regiment was out of date. He was a skilled horseman, but knew nothing about the positioning, loading and firing of the big artillery shells now in use. He had achieved distinction in his examinations in science, military history and mathematics, but had virtually no experience of the devastating new military technology. At 10 o'clock the following morning, Tatiana bounded into the ward full of excitement.
"Malama! Why did you not tell me you won the Stavestny?"
Dmitri had led the field from the start of the previous year's prestigious horse race on Autopo, his cognac mare.
"That was many moons ago," he said. "I'm flattered that you have been researching me."
"Well, of course I have," she said,
sitting on the edge of his bed since there was no chair in sight. In any other girl, he would have thought it a flirtatious gesture, but Tatiana did it naturally, without guile.
"I'm trying to discover what makes you tick."
"I fear I will prove a very dull study."
He smiled. "I am an army officer and keen to return to my regiment as soon as I can, to fight for my country. I'm so predictable I make myself yawn."
I shan't allow you to leave," Tatiana said playfully. "As your colonel, I order you to stay."
He looked further down the ward to where Olga was sitting on the bed of an officer called Karangazov, before replying, "I cannot disobey a direct order. Perhaps you think the army will fare better without me." She giggled.
"Rushing out and getting yourself shot is a drain on manpower. You must stay here to keep me entertained."
"But you are the one doing the entertaining, while I lie here like a useless lump. Life on the ward will be insufferably tedious without your visits to look forward to."
"Perhaps you will soon be able to walk in the grounds with me. The temperature is mild, and the leaves are turning to brilliant reds and yellows."
He glanced out of the tall windows at the clouds scudding past. Every time Tatiana said something personal, his heart leapt. Did she speak to other patients so kindly? Certainly, on their ward, she stopped by his bed far longer than at the others.
"I like that, my colonel," he replied, a little hoarse.
Her mother, Tsarina Alexandra, swept into the room, and Olga and Tatiana leapt off the officers' beds.
"Why don't you change Cornet Malama's dressing?"
the Tsarina instructed Tatiana, giving Dmitri a quick nod of acknowledgement.
"Olga, come with me to the annex."
Tatiana went to fetch water, scissors, and lint, and Dmitri cringed at the thought of her seeing the ugliness of his wound. He knew he was not a bad-looking man, with his dark blonde hair and chestnut eyes, but his left leg was scored by deep gashes on either side that were healing with hideous colours, jagged plum-purple lines surrounded by grey and orange swelling, the skin bald where the hairs had been shaved. At least the wounds no longer bled or oozed pus, but they were imperfections he would rather have hidden. He couldn't watch as her cool fingers cleaned around the wounds. Her touch was causing his manhood to stiffen, and he wriggled to rumple the bedcovers over the spot so she would not notice. It was agonizing and wonderful at the same time. They didn't talk, didn't look at each other, and he wondered if perhaps she was embarrassed too. "You're not bad," he told her as she tied the last knot on the dressing and began to collect her instruments. "There could be a career in nursing for you, if you get bored of being a Grand Duchess."
"Why, thank you, sir."
She bowed with mock politeness.
"I aim to please. I shall be back later to check you are not being disruptive."
She gazed straight into his eyes as she spoke, and he felt a jolt, for all the world as if he had been shot by Cupid's arrow. The words of poets through the generations, words he had previously thought trite and clichéd, suddenly made sense to him. He felt deliriously happy and wildly anxious at the same time. Did Tatiana have romantic feelings for him, or did she simply enjoy his company? How could he let her know he had fallen in love without causing embarrassment or spoiling the intimacy that was developing between them? During the interminable hours of bed rest, Dmitri pondered ways of ascertaining her feelings, then decided that he should give her a gift, something personal, something she would treasure. A book? He had no way of knowing what she had or had not read, and it felt rather a staid present. Jewelry. The family had more ostentatious gold and precious stones than he could ever afford. And then he thought back to the subject of their first ever conversation, and the answer came to him. He would get her a puppy. He knew a St. Petersburg breeder who had some gorgeous French bulldogs. One of them would be perfect, but how would he get it to Tatiana? He wanted to watch her reaction on receiving the gift, so he couldn't simply have it delivered to the Alexander Palace. That evening, the Tsarina's lady-in-waiting, Anna Virabova, came by to straighten his pillows. She was a plump-faced, kindly type, a friend with whom his mother often stayed when she came to St. Petersburg for the social season, and she inquired after his family. Dmitri decided to ask her advice. Did she think it would be acceptable for him to buy a gift of a puppy for Grand Duchess Tatiana? He explained that he wished to surprise her. Anna's face lit up with pleasure.
"How adorable!" she exclaimed. "I'm sure she would love it. What can I do to help?"
Dmitri told her the whereabouts of the breeder and detailed the type of animal he wanted. Not the runt of the litter, but a pup that was confident around people and did not scare easily.
choose the one that comes over to sniff an outstretched hand and squints at you sideways. Avoid any that stand back and bark or bare their teeth. I want a pup who is playful but does not use his teeth. We can't risk him biting the Grand Duchess. Anna agreed she would help with the choice, following Dimitri's advice. She seemed thrilled to be part of the secret. 2 days later, she stopped by his bed to whisper that the breeder had a perfect pup and she had placed the order, but that it would be another week before it would be ready to be taken from its mother. Dimitri was frustrated by the delay. He saw Tatiana every day, and as well as their morning visits, she and Olga now came back in the evenings. They had a lesson with Dr. Vera Gedroitz at 6 o'clock, after which they sterilized the instruments for the following day. If there was time after that, Olga would play piano, and they would sing along to some well-known songs, like the Latvian favorite Kaut Kur. Tatiana sang quietly, but Dimitri could hear she had a pure, tuneful voice. On the day the puppy was ready to be handed over, Dimitri gave Anna Virabova his final instructions about purchasing a basket in which to transport it, a collar, some food, a water bowl, and a litter tray, and he gave her the money to pay for it. When she returned an hour later with the precious cargo in a box, Dimitri glanced in and grinned. It was perfect. Anna went to find Tatiana, who was in the annex. Soon she arrived in the ward, looking flustered.
"Anna Virabova said you needed to see me."
She noticed the box.
"What is this?"
He held it out. "A gift, to thank you for your patience with me." Snuffly panting sounds were coming from within. Tatiana took the box and opened it warily. A tiny black face leaned out to lick her hand, and she squealed in delight. The dog fitted easily into her cupped palms, and she examined the pointy ears, the frown line between the eyes, the wrinkled snout, then bent and kissed the top of its velvety head.
"Malama,"
she began, looking up at him, but could say no more. She was overwhelmed, virtually speechless. But it didn't matter, because Dimitri could see it written in her eyes that she loved him. And now she must know that he loved her too. His heart swelled with such profound happiness, he could scarcely breathe. Chapter 4 October brought chill winds from the Arctic, along with showers of blustery rain. One day, when the rain had eased off, Tatiana found a wheelchair and pushed Dimitri into the beautifully manicured formal gardens of the Catherine Palace so they could start training the little bulldog she had named Autopo after Dimitri's cavalry horse. Dimitri showed Autopo a titbit of chicken, then held out his palm, loudly instructing the dog to sit, while Tatiana pushed on her backside to demonstrate. But as soon as she removed her hand, Autopo leapt at the wheelchair, trying to grab the chicken. Tatiana tried again, only for the pup to jump up and leave muddy paw prints on her white nurse's uniform.
"I think we have an untrainable one here,"
she laughed, brushing at the marks. "No dog is untrainable," he replied, "but this one seems more of a challenge than most. I suspect you are spoiling her when I am not around." At least Autopo had mastered the art of waiting till she got outdoors before relieving herself, which proved a level of obedience, but not much. Despite their efforts, she jumped up at every passerby, barked furiously at the gardeners, and refused to come when called unless food was offered. They laughed till their sides ached as she cavorted around the lawn trying to catch leaves blowing in the wind, or chased huge seagulls who took off into the air when she was just a few feet away.
"What do you think she would do if she caught one?"
Tatiana asked. "She'd get the fright of her life. These giant gulls can be fierce." He felt as though they were proud parents, and was delighted the dog gave them a pretext to spend time together without anyone questioning it. They didn't even have a chaperone. Tatiana had pushed his wheelchair as far as the limestone grotto at the edge of the great pond, when a few spots of rain fell, so they hurried into the grotto to shelter. The exterior walls were decorated with seashells, and the watery theme continued inside with masks of Neptune on the windows, and dolphins and tritons carved on the pillars that supported the domed ceiling. Autopo scooted around sniffing corners, while Dimitri and Tatiana waited by the door for the rain clouds to pass.
"Aunt Ella was asking about you yesterday evening,"
she said, glancing at him shyly. She joked that we seemed to be having a romance. She teased me about it. He hesitated.
Do you think she disapproved?
No, not at all,
Tatiana said quickly.
She said she knows your mother and that you come from a good family. Olga is sweet on an officer called Mitya. Do you know him?
Dmitri nodded and bit back a retort. He found Mitya rather crass.
She talks about him all the time. Even little Alexei teases her, but I suspect she enjoys being teased.
And you do not?
Tatiana hesitated.
I am a private person and prefer to keep my feelings for my journal instead of being the subject of gossip.
How I would love to read that journal, Dmitri twinkled.
Could you bring it to the ward later?
Never!
She exclaimed vehemently, making him laugh.
Do you think this rain will pass soon, or should we dash back and risk a soaking?
Let's linger a while. I might try walking a few steps, if you will lend me your arm.
He pushed down on the arms of the wheelchair to raise himself, then swung the injured leg to the ground, wincing slightly as it took his weight. Tatiana steadied him, and for a moment they were so close he could feel the warmth of her body and hear her breathing. He longed to put his arms around her. If only he dared. She stayed close as he hobbled a few steps to the opposite window, then paused to recover.
"I don't want you to get better so quickly," she cried mournfully. "They will send you back to the front, and then you will forget you ever knew me."
He spoke with passion.
"Tatiana, I will never forget you. Never. If I should be mortally wounded on some foreign battlefield, I swear your name will be the last word on my lips, and your face the last image in my head."
Tears sprang to her eyes, and she blinked them away, turning her head to the side.
"But might the story have a happy ending?"
she asked quietly. "I will do all I can to make sure it does," he breathed. Her face was so close that he could have kissed her by leaning forward just a few inches, but it would be presuming too much. He was sure she could hear how hard his heart was hammering in his chest, because he was certain he could hear hers too. By mid-November, Dmitri could walk across the ward unaided, and he wasn't surprised when he received a letter informing him that he had been past fit for duty and must report to his regiment by the 12th of December. He kept the news from Tatiana for a while, not wanting to distress her. The thought of causing her pain made his chest tighten and a lump form in his throat, but at the same time he hated to keep such an important communication from her. When there were just 2 weeks to go, he took her for a walk through the park, past the pyramid where tiny gravestones marked the burial places of Catherine II's 3 dogs. Autopo nosed the frozen earth as if she could detect something, most likely the scent of a fox.
"I knew this day must be close," she said bravely, and turned her head away, but he could hear that she was choking back tears. "I have some gifts for you. You will be surprised how busy I have been."
"Really? What kind of gifts?" He glowed at the thought.
"I have knitted you a muffler, gloves, and several pairs of thick socks. I don't want to think of you freezing in some bleak, windswept tent."
He was so touched he could barely speak. Was this the moment to kiss her? He hesitated too long, and she had turned to call Autopo, who was chasing a squirrel.
"We must take some photographs," she said. "I'll bring my box brownie to the ward this evening."
"You have hundreds of photographs of me already," he smiled, "and I look ugly in all of them." She and Olga were keen photographers.
"Will you write to me?"
she asked, her tone a little plaintive.
"Of course.
You shall have a letter every week, which is at least 10 times more than my mother gets."
"I shall write to you every day,"
she declared, her eyes glassy. Impulsively, he took her slender hand and pressed it to his lips, lingering to savour the sensation and inhale her precious scent. She did not pull it away. Dmitri dressed in his navy and yellow uniform and set off early on the morning of the 12th of December, along with 2 other officers and 12 soldiers all heading for Poland, where the remnants of the Russian First Army were attempting to hold the German 9th at bay. Dawn had only just broken,
But Tatiana appeared in the palace driveway, looking pale in the wintry sunshine, and stood by the gate to wave. As their truck passed, Dmitri saw her eyes were red with crying, and his heart felt as though it were breaking in two.
Chapter 5. London, April 2016. At first, Kitty thought the letter was junk mail and was about to toss it in the bin. It was written on expensive-looking watermark paper from a company called Inheritance Trackers Incorporated. And as she skimmed the first paragraph, her eye was caught by the name Yakovlevich. She was pretty sure that had been her grandma Marta's maiden name, so she went back to read it properly. It said that she was the great-granddaughter and only living descendant of Dmitri Yakovlevich, who had died in America in 1986, and that his estate had not been claimed. Should she wish Inheritance Trackers to reunite her with this fortune, they would handle all the legal work and would take a fee of only 15%. There was a 30-year deadline for claiming lost estates, and if she did not act soon, the property would be forfeited to the government. Kitty was instantly suspicious. This was an era of scams, when you were offered millions of pounds if you would only advance a couple of thousand to help get someone through customs in an African country, when boiler rooms located in the Bahamas claimed they could quadruple any investment within a year. Besides, Grandma Marta had been alive in 1986. So why had she not inherited Dmitri Yakovlevich's money? Why had Kitty never even heard of him? Marta had been a fun grandmother, who kept delicious sweets in her pottery rabbit candy jar, and was always happy to get down on the floor and play Hungry Hippos or Mousetrap. Kitty couldn't recall her mentioning her father, but then Marta had died when Kitty was 8. She would probably find pictures of him in the old suitcase of family photos she had stowed in the bedroom closet after her parents passed away. She must take a look sometime. She rang the number on the company's letterhead and was put through to someone called Mark, who told her that the inheritance concerned was worth over $50,000 in cash. There was also a cabin on Lake Akanabi in the Adirondack Mountains of northern New York State, which had been uninhabited since her great-grandfather's death, and royalties for some books he had written. He was an author. How intriguing. "So what do I have to do to claim it?" she asked, carefully, picking up a pen. "We'll send you some forms to fill out," explained Mark, "and you return them to us, along with a copy of your birth certificate, and a marriage certificate, if you're married, and we'll do the rest." "Do I have to pay anything up front?" she asked suspiciously. "Legal fees or anything?" "No, we take our cut when the money and the ownership papers for the cabin come through," Mark told her. "Do you want me to send you the information?" "Why not?" she agreed. She forgot to tell Tom that evening, but when the paperwork arrived, confirming the totals, she showed it to him. He didn't seem particularly impressed. 50K minus 15% is $42,500, and at today's exchange rate, that's about 27,000 quid. Better than a poke in the eye. Do you want me to give you the number of a financial advisor who can give you some ideas on investing it?" She looked at him, across the table, and wondered about this stranger she had married. The Tom she had known back in college would have suggested blowing the windfall on a round-the-world trip for two, or perhaps buying a yacht and learning to sail. They were only in their mid-30s. They had paid off the mortgage, thanks to the inheritance when her parents died. Neither of them wanted to have children, and now all Tom could think of was saving for the future. She felt she was seeing him through different eyes than she had a decade ago. Or maybe she was the same person, and he was the one who had changed. It was hard to tell. Back then, he'd wanted to be a composer, and had spent most days writing songs on his keyboard and sending demos to record companies. After they failed to leap at the chance of buying his creations, he chucked it all in, took an accountancy course, and was now working as an auditor for the city council. He had become serious and precise, leaving home at the same time every morning in a neat, predictable suit, the kind of outfit no one would ever notice. If he committed a crime and witnesses were asked to describe him, they'd struggle to come up with anything because he was so nondescript. Short brown hair, hazel eyes, medium height, grey-blue suit, no unusual features. Kitty made fun of him for his plain ties that were always in the same shade as his plain socks, for his trousers that were hung in a trouser press overnight, so the crease fell in exactly the right place. It made her want to raid his drawer and leave only mismatching socks, or to get him drunk and drag him to a tattoo parlour, to have a gothic emblem etched on his forearm. She found it irritating that he drank sensible decaf coffee and brushed his teeth for exactly 2 minutes. She was bored with the weekend sex routine of an orgasm for her, one for him, invariably achieved the same way. He was a good provider, they were lucky not to have money worries, but at some point they had stopped having fun, and she couldn't think when that had happened. The holiday in Costa Rica the previous autumn had been glorious. Christmas with his extended family had been nice, but since then life had felt monotonous, with nothing interesting on the horizon. It didn't help that her own career had stalled. She'd studied journalism at college and always imagined herself flying first class to LA to interview celebrities for Vanity Fair, or breaking the story that David Cameron had a secret lover in a Guardian exclusive. But instead, she reviewed theatre for the local paper in their part of North London. She earned a pittance and had to sit through dire shows at least 3 evenings a week, then churn out 500 words of lively copy that didn't betray how deeply disenchanted she was with theatre as an art form. Her mother's oft-repeated view that writing was a hobby, not a reliable way to earn a living, kept echoing in her head. She'd wanted Kitty to study law, but memorizing all those endless judgments sounded unbearably tedious. Should she have listened? Or should she push herself harder to succeed as a writer? There seemed no urgency when Tom earned enough for them both. She kept planning to write a book, but changed her mind about the subject before managing more than a few thousand words. If she couldn't maintain an interest, how could she expect to hold her reader's attention? "You've always had a lazy streak," her mum used to say. "You get it from your dad's side." Perhaps it was true. She wondered what kind of books Dmitri Yakovlevich had written. She vaguely remembered that Grandma Marta had Russian roots. The surname certainly sounded Russian. Perhaps his work was all in his native language. She'd find out when the royalty statements came through. There was nothing that seemed suspicious in the inheritance tracker forms, so she signed on the dotted line and sent them back with the required certificates. She and Tom vaguely discussed what to do with the cabin in upstate New York, and he was in favour of selling it. "After it's lain empty for 30-odd years, the level of repairs needed to make it habitable would cost more than the thing is worth," he said with his business head. "It might be a good investment," Kitty maintained. "We could renovate, then rent it out through a local agency." She had a flair for DIY. Her father had taught her carpentry skills, and she had already done up 3 properties in London. 2 she sold on at a profit, and 1 in which they still lived. "We'd only be able to rent it 3 months of the year," Tom said. "No one wants a holiday in the Adirondacks in winter, and it wouldn't cover its annual costs on the summer rental alone." Kitty yawned. He didn't seem to see the romance of owning a cabin in the American wilderness. Why had Dmitri bought it? She imagined it must be very beautiful. And then it slipped to the back of her mind over the next few weeks, as she wrote her theatre reviews, had lunch or an early evening drink with friends, took her yoga classes, and ran the household she shared with her sensible, risk-averse husband. Chapter 6. London, the 18th of July, 2016. Kitty could not put her finger on what made her pick up Tom's mobile phone when he went for a run one Saturday morning, leaving it on the hall table. She'd never done that in all the years they'd been together, even though she knew his password and he knew hers. It wasn't a conscious decision to check his texts, but the phone was lying there. She was standing looking at it, and somehow she found herself flicking through his messages. Almost immediately, she found a photo of a naked woman with huge breasts and a message that read, "Want more of this, baby? How about my place? 11 on Saturday morning." It finished with a heart emoji. Kitty's throat seemed to close up, and she could feel the blood pumping in her temples. The sender of the text was called Karen, with 2 R's, and when she scrolled down she found several more texts. telling Tom he was the hottest lover she'd ever had, and making arrangements